This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Australia's number one award-winning show for exploring sex, sexuality, and self.
Hide and seek.
Visit joy.org.au/hide and seek.
Good evening and welcome to Hide and Seek, your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self here on Joy 94.9. A big thank you to the Right Here, Right Now team. It is Andrew the Apprentice here along with Mr. Tim.
Welcome.
How are you?
I'm very well. I'm feeling very relaxed.
Very relaxed? Why?
I just had a nice massage.
Oh,
I'm feeling
okay.
Very centered, at one with the universe, and I just want to be a blob on the floor.
Well, you can be a blob on the floor a little bit later because we'll have to get through a show first.
And you can probably smell my skin from over there.
A little bit. We'll see how worse it gets later on. on tonight's program, Tim, we're going to be talking about IVF.
Babies.
We're talking about baby production, that's right, and how it works for in particular, I guess, members of our communities, in particular, I suppose, lesbian couples, but also how gay men can get involved too.
Very interesting.
Exactly. So all that coming up very shortly with Dr. Melissa Cameron from Melbourne IVF. First, though, Tim, we should mention that our colleague, Mr. Dean Beck.
Thank you, Dean. I've actually had the pleasure of attending one of these.
He has got another seminar happening next Wednesday evening. Tim, what's it all about?
It's about lending a hand.
Lending a hand.
Many hands.
Right.
Inside one particular orifice called fisting.
Fisting, that's what we're talking about. Of course, everyone who is a regular listener to Hide and Seek will know that Mr. Beck, of course, runs his educational seminars down at Manhouse. And he has another one next Wednesday. He can't be here on the show because he's going to be down there. Next Wednesday, the 17th of February.
I have a funny story. So I was at a cafe on the weekend in Collingwood.
No real names here. But
No. And I was chatting to some friends about this particular seminar.
Right.
And as I mentioned the word fisting... The waitress was walking behind me and literally stopped in his tracks.
Right.
And the
A waiter in Collingwood?
Yes.
Okay.
The facial expression apparently was gold. I couldn't see it, but everyone at the table just pissed themselves laughing.
Very good to hear. Yeah, so if you want to register or get more information, head along to manhouse.com.au or give them a call. It is free, being sponsored and supported by Victorian AIDS Council and Living Positive Victoria.
Awesome.
So that is next Wednesday. So get along there and then you could be able to catch up on whatever we are doing next Wednesday on the podcast.
We'll be taking Dean's spot.
That's right.
Lending a hand.
We're lending a hand another way. That's right.
Joy 94.9.
It is Hide and Seek here on Joy 94.9, your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self. Andrew the Apprentice and Mr. Tim are with you this evening. And joining us right now in the studio from Melbourne IVF is Dr. Melissa Cameron. Good evening, Melissa.
Good evening. Thanks for having me along.
That's all right. And now you've been training in obstetrics and gynaecology.
Yes.
So what led you to sort of shift a bit, I guess, into the specialty field of IVF?
To be honest, I had a big background in gynaecology and dealing with a lot of patients who have ongoing medical issues that affect their fertility. And so I often was talking to patients about fertility, about how we can help them get pregnant. I kept on sending them to my colleagues and thought it would be much nicer to actually see them through that process myself. And also having children myself really changed my attitude towards it. And I was a bit like a reformed smoker that everyone should have one. They're fantastic. So I think having been involved in creating a family and seeing other people go through that, and it's really interesting medicine. It's a great variety. You meet a wonderful bunch of people. It really extends you in lots of different ways.
Now, IVF is relatively new, shall we say?
It's about
30 years old?
Yeah, the oldest IVF baby, she must be in her late 30s now. Louise Brown is her name. It's something that all gynaecologists know of. It's almost an exam question. So in terms of medicine.
And that was in Melbourne, still, wasn't it?
No, the first IVF baby was overseas.
Oh, it was overseas, yep.
The UK.
But Victoria was fairly...
Yeah, we've certainly been leading the field for a long time. Yeah. We've got a lot of pioneers that are still helping us out.
I was thinking before, that just as we were coming in, that I seem to, you know, in the back of my mind, I can remember this, the, you know, big stories back in the mid-80s about Victorian and IVF and all that happening here at the time.
Yeah, I know. I'm the same. I remember as well. I remember the first lot of twins born years apart, and that was really when they were looking at freezing embryos, and so you could make a batch of embryos, freeze them, have one baby now, have another one a few years later, and I remember that being big news.
And I suppose as well, you help women become pregnant who have gone through the normal means of trying to have children, sorry, the natural means, and it hasn't worked out. So they're kind of pinning their hopes in a way and investing their emotions and their time in the process.
Yeah, that side of it is, I mean, it's really rewarding, but it also can be quite difficult because, sure. You know, no one really wants to see me, to be honest. It would be great if people didn't have to see me to get pregnant. So I can certainly understand where patients come from. They're often incredibly nervous and anxious about it. It's a really, it can be a really difficult time.
So I'm guessing there's sort of, I guess, three groups of women that you would see. Women who are in heterosexual relationships who are having troubles getting pregnant.
Yep.
Single women and same-sex couples.
Yep.
Same-sex female couples.
Yes. And more now I'm seeing transgendered couples as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit about that.
And also I've seen and gay men as well.
Okay.
Accessing surrogacy. So we see people from all the spectrums, really. So with regards transgendered people, so I'm noticing more and more transgendered individuals wanting to have a baby is independent of gender and independent of sexuality. It's a human desire, I think. And I'm seeing more people that are wanting to access treatment. So mostly I've seen women who have transitioned to become men, who may or may not have partnered but have wanted to access our facilities. And certainly there's ways that we can help them achieve pregnancies as well.
Wow.
Are there limitations for transgendered people?
It really depends. I mean, there's lots of options. Essentially, to make a baby, you need eggs, you need sperm, and you need a uterus. And so it really depends on the individual's situation, what they have and what pieces of that puzzle there are missing.
Sure.
There's certainly no limitations to accessing treatment, apart from our regular limitations. We do have some limitations from age point of view. You know, obviously, you need to be fit and healthy to be pregnant or, you know, to be able to raise a child. But certainly, there's no limitations from them accessing treatment.
Sure.
You're on Heart and Sick. We're talking to Dr. Melissa Cameron about from Melbourne IVF about IVF. So can we get a bit technical? How does IVF work?
So IVF is one of many ways of getting pregnant, but IVF is essentially where you extract eggs from a woman, mix them with sperm from a man, and put them inside a uterus. So you're making embryos outside in the lab and then putting an embryo back inside a uterus.
And when it's happening in the lab, do you wait until you're sure that the embryo is starting to form?
Yes, so there's various processes. First of all, the egg needs to be fertilised, and then we watch the eggs over a number of days
to
see them develop.
And then I'm assuming that they would, once you know the egg's fertilised, obviously it's to a degree a viable, is that the word?
There's a lot of mystery in IVF. Yeah. There's a lot we don't know. Not every egg will fertilise. Not every fertilised egg will go on to form a nice embryo, and even not every nice embryo will implant.
Wow.
So there's certainly a degree of unknown still. There's various tests we can do on embryos and various ways we assess embryos, but certainly it's not a given going through IVF that you're going to get a baby at the end.
And I'm assuming for, doesn't matter the gender of the woman coming in to get IVF, that they'd have to go through a whole series of tests and assessments to check that they're okay to try IVF.
Yeah, there's a whole heap of just routine pre-pregnancy tests that we do, ensuring they're fit and healthy, make sure there's no chronic medical illnesses, ensure there's no gynecological problems, and they're pretty standard for whoever's coming through. Obviously, if you're in a relationship where you've been trying, and that might alter what sort of tests we do, might mean some extra tests to ensure nothing else is going on.
So let's say a lesbian couple were coming in. Let's say one was in their 40s and one was in their 30s. Would you recommend about who is involved in the pregnancy, or and to what levels and degrees? And
yeah, I mean, age is a really important thing, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I see women all the time, every day, where age is one of the major factors that's affecting their fertility. So certainly, if you're going to have babies, aim to start trying before you're 35. To finish a family before you're 40, because really, once you hit your 40s, your chances of pregnancy, even with IVF, really go downhill, and it's all related to egg quality.
So would you be more likely to say the younger lesbian should try?
Yeah, I mean, it partly depends on the individual and how motivated they are, and if they've been counselled as to the pros and cons. But certainly if they want the best chances of achieving a pregnancy, then certainly trying with someone in their 30s are going to be much more likely to be successful than someone in their 40s.
Sure.
For lesbian couples coming in, is it a case that they come... Have you had to counsel and work with couples, I guess, to say, okay, potentially it's better for Mary rather than Jane to carry?
Absolutely. It's a conversation I have almost every day.
Oh, wow.
No, not every day, but most days. But certainly, and often that's a discussion the couple have had within themselves, if they're both wanting to get pregnant, and not every lesbian couple both want to have a baby. And sometimes it's very obvious that one does want to try and one doesn't want to try. But there's lots of things we take into account, but age is predominantly a factor.
So how long would and this may not be a question you can answer, but how long does a standard sort of process take? Is it a once-off?
To try and get
pregnant through IVF?
Yeah, look, it's very individual. It's very much age-based. Generally speaking, you've got about a 30% chance of getting pregnant with a single embryo.
Right.
The other thing we haven't talked about is insemination, which is much simpler than IVF and is often what a lot of women need, you know, particularly in same-sex relationships where really they're untested, mostly from a fertility point of view. Mm-hmm. A lot of women haven't ever tried to get pregnant before. So in that case, if the only thing missing from that equation is sperm, we may be better off trying with insemination first. So that's putting the sperm directly the uterus.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to get to that because I'm guessing that's where the donor stuff happens. But let's touch on the sperm donation a little bit later on. So a third success?
Yeah, roughly speaking. Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's so many individual variations. But overall, a third of people get pregnant per embryo. The longer you try, the more likely you are to succeed.
Sure. And what are some of the most common reasons that women can't fall pregnant?
Mostly age. Age and general health, in particular weight. Being overweight really affects your fertility. If you're overweight, you can reduce your fertility chances by up to about 50%. Same with smoking. You know, if there's anything you can change to improve your fertility, it's reducing smoking and ideally stopping smoking. And really, you know, if you want to get pregnant, this is the time to get as healthiest and as fit as you possibly can. So they're the main things. There are other gynecological things like having a condition called endometriosis, which often causes painful periods, fibroids, which can cause heavy periods. So all of those things can still be present, even though you may not have actually been trying to get pregnant, but they can impact on anyone trying to get pregnant.
Okay, sure.
We hear a bit about often there being multiple pregnancies resulting from IVF. Mm. Is that because you add more than one fertilised egg, or is it something else?
Yeah, mostly it is because we put more than one embryo in. Very much Australia's a leader in putting in single embryos, so one embryo at a time, trying to reduce the risk of having multiple pregnancies. But even when you put a single embryo in, there is a small chance that they will break into two or more, and certainly that's a higher chance of happening compared to a spontaneous pregnancy.
So if, let's say, it happens, you know, as you said, about a third of the time is successful. Is it a case that I would, or a couple would go in once, have a whole range of eggs fertilised, and then have a couple put in and then wait and then already have some eggs in storage?
Yes, so what we would try and do is make a number of embryos, put one embryo back and hopefully have some embryos frozen.
Okay.
So there's really two phases to an IVF cycle. One is stimulating the ovaries to make many eggs and collecting those eggs and then making embryos. The other phase is putting an embryo back. So hopefully you'd have one to put back and then some others to store in the freezer. So if you're fortunate enough, got pregnant with that first embryo, fantastic. You know you've got some stored in the freezer so you can come back later without going through the really intense, much more invasive side of the cycle.
And how much does this process cost someone if they want to go down this path?
Yeah, it partly depends on their Medicare eligibility because there's a significant rebate from Medicare. Also depends on whether they're using donor sperm or not. But generally speaking, for an IVF cycle, you're looking at around $4,000 to $5,000 out of pocket.
Sure.
There's lots of variations to IVF that you can do that can make that more expensive, but generally speaking, that's what you're looking at.
We are speaking with Dr. Melissa Cameron from Melbourne IVF about all things about IVF. We're going to be talking about a little bit about sperm donation as well, and also surrogacy, which I was surprised at picking up as I was having a look tonight. If you've got any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch, 0427JOY949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au.
Hey, this is Dan Savage of Savage Love and the Savage Lovecast, and you are listening to Joy 94.9, Australia's first and only LGBTQIFTSQA community radio station.
You're with Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. Tim Little with you and Andrew the Apprentice. And we're chatting tonight to Dr. Melissa Cameron from Melbourne IVF. And one thing that we haven't yet explored is donors. Particular gay men?
Yeah,
do you get many?
Absolutely. We have a lot of gay men who donate to our sperm donation program. Basically, we don't discriminate on the basis of sexuality. We just want men to be fit and healthy. Even just healthy is enough. We don't need to be too fit. Age between 25 and 45, and they go through a process of counselling and medical checks to ensure that everything's okay and there's no infections predominantly is what we're looking for.
Sure.
And then we quarantine their sperm for 3 months and check them again, and then if that's okay, then we can release the sperm for use.
And do they find out what happens with it?
Yeah, they can. They can contact our donor team, as in to see how many children have been conceived and born. They can contact and find out information regarding that.
Because I had an ex-flatmate who, he was a donor for two lesbians, and they went through a similar program. So in those kind of cases, would they all come in together and say, this is what we want to do?
Yeah, so this is a situation of a known, what we call a known donor.
Yep.
The donors, to a degree, are treated the same way in that everyone needs to go through counselling.
Mm-hmm.
Often if you're donating to someone you know, you'll go through joint counselling together, mm-hmm. But you'll also have separate counselling sessions also. But that donor will still have the same blood tests done, the same sort of infection disease screens. We do some genetic screening tests as well. So they'll go through the same process. The sperm will still be quarantined and then be able to be used at the end of the day.
Wonderful.
I did have a situation, Tim, once, where I went out on a date with somebody.
Yes.
and went home, and he's gone, oh, sorry, I can't do anything tonight.
Because,
because in a day or two, I've got my appointment with the IVF clinic, and my lesbian sister and her partner are asking me to be the donor.
I think that's a really good point, because I see some couples that have a known donor. A lot of women out there will have a donor at home.
Yep.
And, or not necessarily at home, but they'll use a donor they know and try and conceive at home. And it's things like that that they really need to take into account and talk to their donor about that. Well, if we want an optimum sample, then you have to abstain for a little while. We would like you to have safe sex for a while. So it's quite a task on behalf of the donor.
Yep.
So that can sometimes, you can get what we call donor fatigue, if that is such a thing. But certainly that's something to take into account. When you have the situation where all the sperm's been frozen and quarantined, then it makes the logistics of it sometimes a little easier.
Now, I was reading here, 100,000 sperm needed is the preferred number, I believe. And is that in one sample? Or is that...
Oh, that's in one sample. You'd have far many more. I'd hope many more than that in one sample. So generally, there's lots of things we look at when we look at a sperm sample. Everyone gets very fixated on number, and we like more than 15 million per mil. And you only need one to do the job, so overcompensation. But we also look at how motile they are, whether they're swimming in the right direction, what they actually look like, so the appearance of the sperm as well. So there's lots of things we look at. But generally, when we're looking at insemination, we aim for samples where there's more than 2 million per sample.
Wow, that's quite a lot when you think about it.
Well, when you consider women only produce one egg each month, and you guys are producing gazillions of sperm
yeah.
almost every day.
It's amazing, isn't it, really? So I'm assuming a donor would also need to have a good understanding of their family background?
Yeah, absolutely. We ask a very detailed genetic history about sort of extended relatives and so on. So, I mean, if you are interested in being a donor but you don't know that, it doesn't preclude you. But we just do ask you to answer the questionnaire as truthfully as you can.
Sure.
And if there's any concerns, then we get it reviewed.
Now, one thing I wanted to touch on was that there was some changes to the Victorian laws late last year around privacy and about contact between donors and any offspring. Can you touch a little bit on what that is?
Yeah, the history of donor sperm in Victoria I think is quite interesting. So prior to 1988, it was all completely anonymous. So you could turn up. Traditionally, the urban myth is it was all medical students turning up, $50, here you go, off you go, you've got your beer money, it's all anonymous. Between 88 and 1997, there was a voluntary register, so donors could choose to be registered with the aim that any conceived offspring would be able to contact them or at least get details about them. And then after 1997, it became mandatory that all our donors are registered so that any child who's born as a result of donor insemination or donor conception can then access details about their donor once they turn 18. The changes in legislation which came in about June last year were really to put the pre-1988 situation in line with the 88 to 97. So allow a donor conceived offspring to access information about the donor, but it does need to be with the donor's consent at the moment.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's not sort of open slather at the moment, although there are proposals to really make it mandatory that the donors need to provide that information.
And do you go through kind of an aftercare process with the person going through getting IVF, and how long does that process go for?
So do you mean once they've had a baby?
Yeah.
We do to a degree, as in Melbourne IVF do have facilities to help people find out information about their donor, but it's mostly managed now through the Victorian Registry of Births, Deaths and Marriages.
Okay.
And VARTA, which is the Victorian Assisted Reproductive Treatment Authority. They're the overseeing body, and they have a lot of resources and a lot of supports for donor-conceived children and for people who have had donor-conceived children or even considering it. They've got a fantastic website.
I guess it'd be interesting to know whether parents are actually telling their children that they were conceived that way.
Yeah, well, if you look traditionally, you know, the history of who's used sperm over time has really changed.
Sure.
So traditionally it was heterosexual couples where often the guy had significant sperm problems or no sperm.
Mm.
And many families wouldn't tell their offspring that they were donor conceived. It was a big sort of hush-hush secret. Obviously, when you have a same-sex couple, kids are pretty cluey. They work things out after a while and want to know where they come from. So mostly there's this disclosure that happens, and certainly there's been a lot of work looking at, and you know, how to tell kids, when to tell kids, and VARTA do run a seminar usually once a year called the Time to Tell Seminar, which is a fantastic seminar and, you know, has a lot of guest speakers, some donors, some donor-conceived kids, some parents that really help them sort of go through that. But mostly I find now people are into open disclosure. It's really hard to keep a lie within a family. It's a really stressful thing. And, you know, all these things always come out at the worst time. Someone's died or someone's got a medical emergency. You know, it's the last time you want to hear about that.
And that medical aspect, I guess, is one of the reasons, I guess, that the state government changed the laws, isn't it?
Because
there was that need for information around genetic backgrounds and family history.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, a lot of it is also a natural curiosity to know where you came from. And I think if you don't know, it must be an itch that you just need to scratch as well.
Is there an opportunity for somebody who made a donation back in the back in 1990?
Mm.
Is there an option for them to remain distant?
At the moment, there is, because they would exist within the voluntary register.
Yeah.
But there are moves ahead to try and change that.
Yep.
So,
all right. You are on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9. We are chatting with Dr. Melissa Cameron about IVF and donation. And surrogacy is something that I didn't know about until this evening. But we're going to be finding out a lot about that very shortly here on Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Hide and Seek on Joy 94.5. I've been sleeping too much, I think.
You're too relaxed after you mess up.
I know. Your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self. We're with Dr. Melissa Cameron from Melbourne IVF. And we've been talking a lot about IVF tonight. One thing we haven't touched too much on yet, though, is surrogacy. And you guys also do that as well.
Yeah, we do. Since 2010, there were some major changes to legislation in 2010, one of which was surrounding surrogacy and making it much easier to access surrogacy within Victoria. So Melbourne IVF does have a big surrogacy program. We have one of the biggest surrogacy programs in Australia at the moment. And we've recently had, I think it's our 22nd surrogacy baby, which is really exciting.
Because, I had thought until tonight that it was all illegal here in Australia.
No, look, it's not. It varies a lot between states. It's one of those vagaries of living in Australia where there's the state and the federal legislation. Fertility legislation is generally state-based. So now in Victoria we do have access to surrogacy, which is fantastic, but a lot of people still don't know about it.
So how does it work in Victoria?
So in Victoria you need to... It's all altruistic surrogacy. So there's no commercial surrogacy. If we have what we call the commissioning parents or parent. They are the people that find a surrogate. So the surrogate is someone who will carry the baby. The surrogate can't carry a baby that's genetically related to her, so the eggs need to come from someone else, either the commissioning parent or, in the case where you have a gay male couple, they'll need an egg donor as well. So it can become quite complicated, complex.
And how close can that genetic link be?
Between the...
The egg donor and the carrying mother, the surrogate.
So the situation.
So could eggs be provided by a sister? If I was a gay couple, could my sister provide the eggs and then another sister carry?
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, as long as she's not carrying her own genetic eggs.
Okay, her own eggs,
that's the main thing. And we have, we have many couples where, say, a sister is the surrogate, and in a heterosexual couple, you know, it might be her sister who is her own egg, and her sister is being the one carrying the baby.
Okay.
So we do have that,
And where do you draw the line between altruistic and commercial surrogacy? Because that would be quite a fine line, especially if you're paying for medical costs and things like that.
Look, there are guidelines as to what costs can be included. There's certainly no, in the situation in, say, overseas, a lot of people have heard of overseas surrogacy, there will be a particular set fee that you will pay for your egg donor. You'll pay this fee for your surrogate. We don't have that in Victoria. It's very much up to the individuals and what's worked out between them.
Right.
So if I'm a gay couple and I want to use surrogacy, and let's say my sister wanted to be the surrogate. Mm-hmm. Well, firstly, do I have to have a surrogate? Do I have to bring a surrogate along with me?
Well, we can't legally help you find a surrogate.
Okay.
So you do need to find your own surrogate, which is really difficult because you're not able to advertise for a surrogate.
So you really have to get someone from your own network.
Partly, yeah. And look, mostly when people get the word out, it's, you know, especially nowadays with social media, one person tells another person who tells another person, and then, often that's how people find their own surrogates.
So gay couple, got my sister who's the surrogate coming along. Melbourne IVF can get eggs, donor eggs?
Not at this stage.
No, can't do that.
You need to. I know, that's where the complicated comes. Part of the difficulty is. I know it is, isn't it? It really is. Part of the difficulty with egg donors, it's a much more straightforward, simple process to go through and become a sperm donor, in that actually obtaining sperm is much easier compared to obtaining eggs. It's more difficult for a woman who's an egg donor needs to go through really the first part of an IVF cycle. So we don't at the moment have an egg bank set up. But you can advertise for egg donors.
Right. Okay.
In strict conditions.
Yep, sure. Yep. So a gay couple would have to find their own surrogate and find an egg.
Yep.
And more than one egg, as you were saying before.
Well, hopefully the one person would choose an egg donor who has multiple eggs.
Wow.
So it is really complex. And that's only the finding people. That's not actually going through the process of counselling. There's extensive counselling. There's psychological reviews. There's legal advice that you need to get and so on.
So basically you need to find a uterus.
Yes.
You need to find sperm and an egg.
Yep, it's the same recipe for everyone.
And from three different sources.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow.
But it is available.
That's one thing
we'll learn this evening, definitely.
And I'm hoping with time, I mean, it's one of these areas of fertility that very much polarises people. They either go, yep, it's a great thing, or they find it really abhorrent. But I'm hoping with time, you know, there's so much discussion about surrogacy, there's so much discussion about donor-conceived families and structure of families and how it's, you know, that nuclear family isn't the norm anymore, that I'm hoping with time it will become more acceptable. Hopefully the legislation will start shifting and make it easier for couples to access it.
And with the couples that you've dealt with so far, what has been the main reasons they've decided to go down this path? Because it seems like quite a lot of effort.
Sometimes they don't have any other option.
Okay.
So it's mostly heterosexual couples that I've dealt with, but sometimes they have no other option. Mm. And some of the couples I've dealt with have considered overseas surrogacy, but haven't found that it fits with their values or ethics.
Sure.
Mostly.
Yeah. And I'm guessing as a... Now, this is coming from somebody who doesn't really... I wouldn't be doing this, but at a personal level. However... obviously, lots of people do desire to have children, and there seems to have been a shift, obviously, with IVF coming in, that people go down that path as opposed to the adoption path, as we understand here in Victoria in particular, that there's very, very few adoptions, where it sounds like there's a lot more IVF happening, because I suppose people want their own child.
Yeah, partly that, and also in Victoria with these 2010 legislative changes, that's also where there were big shifts for women in same-sex relationships and single women. Before that, they couldn't access treatment here because unless they were medically infertile because of the legislation. That changed in 2010, and so now we have more women being able to access it. If it's easier to access, more people start becoming interested in doing it as well. But you're right, there's hardly any children that are available or come up for adoption. A lot of people foster, and there's a big need for foster parents as well. But I think there is that sort of, again, it's a curiosity as, well, what would a little me look like? You know, what would it like actually be parenting a child?
Now, Melissa, on this coming Tuesday, the 16th of February, in particular for lesbian couples, there is a seminar, a fertility seminar happening about creating family through a donor. Can you briefly touch on what's being covered in that?
Yeah, so that will cover a lot of issues. Firstly, sort of some general health and, you know, how do you get pregnant? What is the process? There'll be a bit of discussion about having a clinic recruited donor, so someone we've found versus having a known donor or someone you found yourself. A lot of the legislative stuff, especially regarding parenting, the legal side of things, the rights and responsibilities you have as parents versus what a donor has, which is essentially they're not considered a father, they don't have any rights or responsibilities under the legislation. Those sorts of issues will be covered.
So the Creating a Family Through a Donor seminar is happening on Tuesday the 16th of February, 6:30 p.m. in East Melbourne. It is all free, so get along. You can find out more at mivf.com.au, and there's a little blurb there about fertility seminars, and you can find all the details there and register via the website. Dr. Melissa Cameron, thank you so much for joining us here this evening on Hide and Seek, letting Tim and I know all about IVF.
Yes, very interesting.
Very interesting. So all the best. And as I said, that seminar Tuesday the 16th of February at 6:30 p.m. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Now, Tim, it's time for you and I to head out of here in a few minutes' time. All of our podcasts, including this one, will be up on our all the existing ones are up on the website, joy.org.au/hideandseek.
Yes, they are.
Big thank you to David, who gets them all done for us.
He's very, very quick.
Usually the delay is, of course, us
writing
up the blurb that needs to go on to the website. But anyway, big thank you to Tim. Now, don't forget, next Wednesday evening, 17th of February,
we're back.
We are. Of course we are. We're here at 9 o'clock. But some of you will be not able to listen to us because you'll be at Mr. Dean Beck's seminar, education seminar down at Mann House. Don't forget that's on Wednesday the 17th from 7 p.m. Strictly limited spaces. Men only, 18 years and over. Go to manhouse.com.au to register or give them a call tomorrow. Make sure you get
along.
Lend
a hand.
Lending Hand is the name of the seminar. That's about all from us tonight, Tim.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up next is JB with Strip Down. This has been Hide and Seek on Joy 94.9, your program for exploring sex, sexuality and self.
You can subscribe to Hide and Seek's podcast for free. Visit joy.org.au/hideandseek for more information. Suggest a topic, a guest or provide feedback. Email hideandseek@joy.org.au. Hide and Seek is presented by Andrew the Apprentice, James Findlay and Avi Miller. Post-production by David Cheshire.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek.
Hide and Seek. Hide and Seek.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.